Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Jessup Bonner of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, who talks about the campaign to defeat the proposed Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement in the U.S. after the pact was signed in New Zealand on February 4th. Stephen Zunas, professor of politics at the University of San Francisco, who examines Hillary Clinton's 2002 vote supporting President Bush's Iraq War and other foreign policy issues. And Carrie Schenkman, a U.S. attorney representing WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, who discusses the recent ruling by a UN panel that found that Assange is being arbitrarily detained in Ecuador's London embassy. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Fifteen years ago, the fertile fields near La Hormiga, Colombia, were filled with coca leaves growing everywhere and farmers flush with cash as a leftist insurgency prospered. This was ground zero for Plan Colombia, a massive multi-pronged effort funded by nearly $10 billion in U.S. aid that was launched in the year 2000. The program's goal was to assist a country with a dysfunctional government and economy in the grips of drug mafias, leftist guerrilla groups, and right-wing militias. But the security gains came at a high cost. In the first 3 years of the plan, 1.8 million people were forcibly displaced from their homes as violence and aerial spraying peaked. The military, which received the bulk of U.S. aid, was embroiled in a scandal in which soldiers executed as many as 3,000 civilians and presented them as combat deaths to inflate the body count. Over the last decade, Colombia's economy has improved and the level of violence has fallen sharply. Now, Colombian President Manuel Santos and the leftist FARC rebels are in the final stages of crafting a peace agreement. Santos visited the White House in early February to seek more aid for war-torn communities. But by any measure, Plan Colombia's original goal of eradicating the nation's cocaine crop has failed. Colombia remains the world's top producer of cocaine, with more than 279,000 acres of coca being cultivated in 2014, only slightly below 1999's figures. The new Cuba PAC has raised $350,000 in recent months to support federal candidates who favor easing the U.S. embargo against Cuba. The PAC plans to raise another $100,000 in political funds for House and Senate candidates before November. Among the early donors for the new Cuba PAC are Mike Fernandez, a major donor to Jeb Bush's presidential campaign, former U.S. Secretary of Commerce Carlos Gutierrez, Pat Riley, president of the Miami Heat NBA basketball team, and the Marriott International Hotel chain. The anti-embargo PAC could play an influential role in the campaign to elect a successor to Florida Republican senator and presidential candidate Marco Rubio. Several potential Democratic and GOP candidates appear supportive of improving U.S.-Cuba relations. The new Cuba PAC competes directly with the pro-embargo U.S.-Cuba Democracy Pact, which is pushing for the return of market capitalism to the island nation and currently has $200,000 to back pro-embargo candidates. Not long ago, Wisconsin was the hub of progressive politics in the U.S., but in recent years, the upper Midwestern state has swung hard right as GOP Governor Scott Walker and the Republican-dominated legislature passed anti-union laws, gutted environmental protections, and slashed education budgets. 2 years ago, Democrats ran Mary Burke, a corporate CEO, against Scott Walker, offering a conservative, light economic agenda with a handful of moderately progressive positions thrown in. Many grassroots activists and rank-and-file workers sat out the election. Now, 52-year-old progressive strategist Robert Craig, who worked for Citizens Action and the Service Employees International Union, is looking to reinvent the progressive movement in Wisconsin. Working with the Wisconsin Council of Churches and the state's Council on Children and Families, Craig is working on a plan to end poverty and reverse growing income inequality in the state. A long-term goal is cutting the rate of child poverty in half. Craig believes that common-sense Keynesian economics could replace the current conventional wisdom that what corporate America wants is good for the economy. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
Trade representatives of the U.S. and 11 other Pacific Rim nations gathered in New Zealand on February 4th to formally sign the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement that's designed to integrate 40% of the world's economy. Over the next 2 years, the controversial trade pact, known as the TPP, must still be ratified by at least six original signatories, representing 85% of the total GDP of the 12 nations that signed the agreement. While supporters like the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and President Barack Obama say the TPP will boost American exports and create jobs, some economic studies warn that the trade agreement will lead to employment losses and increased inequality. U.S. Senator Elizabeth Warren, Democrat of Massachusetts, an opponent, said recently that the TPP is about letting multinational corporations rig the rules on everything from patent protection to food safety standards to benefit themselves. The contentious investor-state dispute settlement provision of the TPP allows multinational corporations to challenge local, state, and federal public health, environmental, consumer, and labor laws, as well as court rulings, if a claim is made that they impinge on business profits. Your reporter spoke with Jessa Bonner, International Program Associate with Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, who explains why a broad coalition of labor, environmental, and consumer groups are now engaged in a campaign to defeat the TPP when the trade agreement comes up for a vote in the U.S. Congress.
The Trans-Pacific Partnership, which we refer to as the TPP, is a so-called free trade agreement, and we put the free trade in quotes, between 12 countries, and it's been in negotiation for about 7 years. And the reason that we put the free trade in quotes is because really the TPP has to do with a lot more than what we think of as typical trade issues. So of the TPP's 30 chapters, actually only six of them have to do with these traditional trade issues in terms of lowering, getting rid of tariffs, etc. But instead what we've seen in the TPP is that there are many provisions that actually benefit multinational corporations over workers, the environment, consumers, etc. So this is not actually that surprising, given how the deal was negotiated. So as I mentioned, it was in negotiations for about 7 years. It took a really long time, in part because there was a lot of opposition, global opposition to the deal. But it was basically negotiated in secret. And so the public and the press and civil society were locked out of the negotiations. For the majority of the time that the TPP was in negotiations, U.S. members of Congress were locked out too. And at the end, they received, after a lot of complaining, they received some kind of nominal access where they could request to view certain parts of it. They couldn't talk about it. They couldn't take any notes, et cetera. But at the same time, as all of these actors were locked out, there were about 500 so-called advisors. So the majority of them representing industry interests, representing corporate interests, that actually had access to the text and the negotiations. And so it's not surprising that the TPP, you know, would benefit these corporations over workers and consumers. And when they finally released the text, we actually saw that it was worse than we thought it would be. There's a lot of concerns. For example, it includes the same kind of language that was in NAFTA that actually makes it easier for big corporations to offshore more American jobs. The TPP would also push down our wages for the jobs that are left because it basically pits American workers more directly in competition with, for example, workers in Vietnam who might make less than 65 cents an hour. It includes monopoly rights for big pharmaceutical companies that raise medicine prices. It would flood us with more imports of unsafe food. It also includes the very controversial investor-state dispute settlement, which allows corporations to challenge public interest policies that they can say affects their ability to make a future profit. There's concerns about internet freedom, rolls back environmental standards. Really, as you mentioned, there's kind of something for everyone to hate. And that's why there's an unprecedented number of organizations that are working against the TPP to try to make sure that Congress will reject it.
Tell us about the candidates running for president, both on the Democratic and Republican side, and their support or opposition to the TPP, to the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement.
In no small part due to the large amount of opposition to the deal, this has really become a politically toxic issue. And really, at this point, the TPP might not even be sent to Congress for approval during this Congress, given that we're an election year and there's been enough pushback. There really isn't a clear majority of support, particularly in the House of Republicans. The people that are in the presidential race that are running for president have really kind of felt the pushback from the American citizens that this is really not a popular issue, that Americans are really opposing this. And because of that, the major people that are vying for the presidency have really had to come out in opposition to the TPP. So, you know, we have Hillary came out opposing the TPP as well as Bernie Sanders. So both of the candidates that are running on the Democrat side, as well as many of the major candidates that are in the Republican race. So we're really seeing that this issue is one that is really, really politically toxic. And for that reason, the movement to defeat the TPP is really alive and well, and it's very much not a sure thing that Congress would approve the TPP or that it will even be brought up for a vote.
Jess, lastly, are there any public opinion polls that have been done recently on public attitudes towards this proposed Trans-Pacific Partnership?
One of the thing that tends to come out of polls are that people tend to kind of support the idea of free trade, but once you get started talking about the provisions that are in the trade deals, NAFTA, previous trade agreements, and what the TPP will actually do, there's a lot of opposition to these types of NAFTA-style deals.
That was Jessa Bonner, International Program Associate with Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. For more news and commentary on the battle to defeat the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Apart from mentions of Hillary Clinton's emails when she was Secretary of State, foreign policy issues have not received much attention thus far in the Democratic presidential nomination campaign. While Republican candidates try to outdo each other in the machismo of their proposed harsh treatment of refugees, targeting family members of alleged terrorists, and attacking rogue nations, Democrats have mostly focused on issues like the economy, higher education, and health care, with some talk about how they tackle climate change. The one exception is Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders' repeated criticism of Hillary Clinton's 2002 Senate vote authorizing the U.S. invasion of Iraq, while pointing out that he opposed that same war resolution. Clinton has since said that her vote was a mistake, but also couched her admission in ways to minimize the negative fallout. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Stephen Zunas, professor of politics and coordinator of Middle Eastern studies at the University of San Francisco. He examined some of the details of the debate in Congress leading up to that vote, which was followed a few months later by President Bush's decision to launch the U.S. shock and awe invasion of Saddam Hussein's Iraq. Here he explains how Clinton's vote supported President Bush and Vice President Cheney's war, and also discusses Hillary and Bernie's position on another key foreign policy issue, U.S. support for Israel.
One of the most disturbing things about the prospect of Hillary Clinton becoming the Democratic nominee for president was that she was among the right-wing minority of Democratic members of Congress to vote in favor of the authorization for the use of military force against Iraq. Most Democrats at the time opposed this. And many people, myself included, who were strategic analysts, Middle East scholars, you know, others familiar with the region and the procurement process of non-conventional weapons, had informed her, along with other members of Congress, that the Bush administration's claims about Iraq having the so-called weapons of mass destruction or ties to al-Qaeda and the like were completely false. And, of course, we were correct on that. We also pointed out the fact that engaging in an aggressive war like this was a direct violation of the United Nations Charter, the Nuremberg Principles, and other basic tenets of international law. It would be a very bad precedent for the United States, which sees itself as a world leader, to insist that it somehow could not play by the rules. Also, we informed her that it would be very likely that if the United States invaded Iraq, we would be bogged down in a long, bloody counterinsurgency war in the midst of the rise of sectarianism and ethnic violence, as well as encouraging the growth of radical Salafi Islamic extremists and terrorism. Unfortunately, we were right about that as well. This came to light a couple nights ago during the town hall meeting where Hillary Clinton claimed that Hans Blix, the UN inspector, supported the resolution. That is completely untrue. He did not support that or any other piece of legislation. He did say that there needed to be inspectors and should be allowed to return to Iraq, and that the United Nations should make sure there be serious consequences if they did not. And the UN did that in UN Security Council Resolution 1441. But he did not say that the U.S. Congress should do that, or the United States should act unilaterally in that regard. There are several war authorization resolutions. One was introduced by Carl Levin, Democratic from Michigan, that said it authorized the president to use military force if the United Nations found that Saddam Hussein was not cooperating with U.N. inspectors, that if he did not let them in, if he did not give them unfettered access to various suspected sites. She was really only interested in getting the inspectors back in. She would have voted for that resolution. Instead, she voted against it, and instead voted for a Republican resolution, the administration's resolution, which gave President Bush the authority to invade Iraq at the time and circumstances of his own choosing. Indeed, inspectors had been in Iraq for 4 months. Unfettered inspections, they weren't finding a damn thing. Bush invaded anyway, and Clinton defended it. Clinton supported it.
Whenever Bernie talks about this, he uses the exact same words to say he voted against it and she was for it, and that demonstrates he has better judgment. But they don't seem to talk about any other foreign policy issue. What can you say, for example, about their differences, if any, around Israel and Palestine? And any thoughts about why this important issue isn't playing any role in the campaign so far?
Well, both Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton support Israel's right to exist and support Israel's right to self-defense. Bernie Sanders worked on a kibbutz as a young man. He's Jewish, and he does, like Hillary Clinton, see Israel as a homeland for the Jewish people. But the big difference is that while Bernie Sanders supports the peace and human rights community in Israel, the more left-leaning Zionist parties, the ones that believe that that Israel should withdraw from the occupied territories and allow the Palestinians a viable state of their own, those who believe that Israel has been violating human rights and has been unnecessarily bombing civilian targets and committing war crimes, Hillary Clinton has defended all that. In fact, even when Israel bombed a United Nations school that was housing refugees during the war on Gaza a year and a half ago, there was no Hamas military activity anywhere nearby. Senator Sanders condemned it. The Obama administration condemned it. But Hillary Clinton rushed to the Israelis' defense, claimed that despite any evidence, there was Hamas firing rockets from an annex of the school. Again, an investigation showed that wasn't true.
Stephen Zunis, I do think uncritical support for Israel is slipping in the U.S., but this issue is still a third rail in American politics. And I'm wondering if Bernie isn't highlighting any differences because he's afraid it will hurt him.
I don't think necessarily. I think part of it is that there are some elements that don't just oppose the occupation, but oppose Israel itself. And he doesn't want to encourage that into things. And he is certainly ahead of the curve in terms of most Democrats. There are a lot of otherwise liberal Democrats who take pretty right-wing positions on this issue, which is unfortunate. Until very recently, when he started bringing Iraq up more often, he hasn't really been addressing U.S. foreign policy much at all.
That was Stephen Zunis, professor of politics and coordinator of Middle Eastern studies at the University of San Francisco. For more analysis of Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders' foreign policy positions, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, an Australian citizen, was granted asylum in Ecuador's London embassy 3.5 years ago, as he faced extradition to Sweden to answer questions on rape and sexual assault charges. While Assange denied the allegations, he refused to travel to Sweden, fearing that the government there would extradite him to the U.S., where he could face serious charges for leaking hundreds of thousands of classified U.S. military and diplomatic documents in 2010. Those documents were a great embarrassment to the U.S., exposing covert spying and military operations, as well as a video recording of U.S. helicopter gunships killing Iraqi civilians and 2 Reuters reporters. Assange's legal status in the U.S. is uncertain after a 2010 grand jury investigation found that there was sufficient evidence to bring charges against the whistleblower related to his release of U.S. documents given to WikiLeaks by Army Specialist Chelsea Manning, who was sentenced to 35 years in prison in August 2013. In a new development in the case, the United Nations Working Group on Arbitrary Detention issued a ruling on February 5th that found Assange's detention in Ecuador's London embassy should come to an end, and that he has the right to compensation for the more than 3 years he spent in illegal detention there. Your reporter spoke with Carrie Shankman, a U.S.-based attorney working on behalf of Julian Assange, who talks about the UN Working Group's ruling and the wider significance of the Assange case for both journalists and activists.
For the last 16 months, the UN's highest authority on detention has been conducting an independent investigation into the case. And after examining all the evidence that the UK and Sweden presented, on Friday, the UN announced that both countries were arbitrarily detaining Assange. So what that means is that the UN acknowledged that he is in fact detained, and second, that the reason for that detention is unjustified. So there's really 2 important pieces that come out of that. One, this is in effect the UN acknowledging the risk of onward extradition that Mr. Assange faces to the United States. And that sets a very important precedent for whistleblowers. As many listeners know, Edward Snowden currently enjoys asylum in Russia after disclosing NSA documents that have resulted in several U.S. programs being held unlawful by 2 branches of government. And it's widely recognized that whistleblowers face unprecedented persecution in the United States. So this is really kind of another step in that recognition of the risks that whistleblowers face. And the second part is that the underlying detention is not justified any longer because Sweden's really been dragging its feet with this case, hasn't been responding to the calls to question him. So that's why the UN came forward and said that Assange is arbitrarily detained and entitled to compensation.
This United Nations Working Group's ruling, as I understand it, really doesn't have the force of law in Britain or anywhere else. What is the concrete result of this ruling, if you would tell us?
Well, as an international lawyer, I can say actually that the reports that this doesn't have the force of law are actually factually incorrect. Actually, the West regularly relies on decisions by this working group when Western nationals are detained. So recently, the president of Maldives was released following an opinion by the working group. And actually, the Washington Post, many listeners might remember, a Post journalist was detained in Iran by the name of Jason Rezaian. And actually, one of the very first things that the Post did was file an urgent petition with this very same group that decided in Assange's case. And what's really interesting is if you put side by side the way that, like the New York Times and many outlets have written about this UN group in the Washington Post case, contrasted with Assange's case, there's really a black and white difference between the attitude towards the group, showing a lot of respect in the former and dismissal in the latter. So this is something that does carry the force of law. It is based on binding international legal obligations, and I think the most compelling point from our perspective, filing the thing, is that the UK and Sweden actually participated in this process and submitted to the jurisdiction of this body. They didn't simply ignore it.
Well, just a final question, Carrie, and that is this. Have you seen evidence of a chilling effect on journalism and activists providing
heretofore secret documents revealing wrongdoing by governments or corporations as a result of what's happened to Julian Assange?
I think absolutely. I mean, there's no question about it. You know, I'm actually working on a book about the Espionage Act, and one of the things that I've learned in that research is that, you know, this law is one that is considered by the mainstream press, but I think following the WikiLeaks case and the publicity it's received, I think a lot of the big outlets are very concerned about publication. Now, you have some courageous, publications like The Intercept, which regularly publish the Snowden documents, and, you know, they still have shops set up. So I think we're not quite at the stage where we have a completely censored press, but I do know, and you see it with actually mainstream journalists. So you have like James Rosen, James Risen, who've been dragged through the mud by the Espionage Act because of their alleged relationships with their sources. The First Amendment protects a open, robust, and uninhibited press for the reason that freedom of the press is required to have effective checks on government, and also to make sure that we as citizens can participate and know how can we vote, how can we participate democratically without knowing what's actually happening with our government. And that, of course, is the reason why we have freedom of information laws. That's why we have a strong First Amendment. But really what the case against Mr. Assange and WikiLeaks threatens to do is undermine the very core of the First Amendment. And that actually is one reason why free press organizations around the world condemn the ongoing case. Actually, just after the UN decision came out, Anthony Romero, who's the executive director of the ACLU, he put out a statement in support of the opinion, and he said that the U.S. case against Mr. Assange is, quote, unprecedented and unconstitutional.
That was Carrie Schenkman, a U.S.-based attorney working on behalf of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. Find more news and analysis of Assange's detention and the UN panel's ruling by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show, which is celebrating 25 years on the air in 2016. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Richard Hill, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.